The Game Master Certification Organization presents.
Greetings and salutations, friends. Welcome back to the Game Master Certification Organization Podcast Expert Series. This is Season 1, Episode 3, with the subject title of World Building. This episode centers on honorary world building expert Bo from the Guild of Navigators. Bo is Czech, GM'd for 30 plus years, speaks 8 languages, and works internationally as a translator. In his spare time, he works with the Guild of Navigators as creative director on their digital assets. Search Guild of Navigators on Patreon to view his portfolio of masterpiece maps, virtual tabletop tokens, and game design pointers. You can also learn more on our website, GameMasterCertification.org. Once there, check out other episodes in this and other series. Game Master Certification is dedicated to the common good. Humanity needs joy. Play to bring joy.
It's having the joy of doing, of creating, of making stuff, and of course, seeing people using the stuff I create, and seeing people to play with it, and utilize it in their own games, or even seeing my guys who I'm playing with to be happy about the maps or the tokens for the games done. So I would say. It would be fun. Number one is always fun. Hi guys, I'm Bo from the Guild of Navigators. I would say I am for 30 years avid player of role-playing games, being a game master myself as well. I am primarily map maker and a token maker. Beside that, doing quite a lot of gaming design, changing of rules for games, and writing additional modules for multiple games. You can find me on Patreon under Guild of Navigators, and you can find a lot of free stuff there for your games, maps, of continents, of smaller cities, bigger cities, battle maps, and gaming tokens, top-down style tokens for your games. So head over there and get your free share of some fun and games accessories. You know, being a game master is not only just being able to write down a few monster names and when you meet them and what, but really being a game master actually starts to work on your creative skills. So first would be writing. You have to come up with a story. You have to come up with how you incorporate the story into the life of your players, how you make it actually a story that's not going to bore them. So you need to create points of suspense. You need to create something that they have to find. They have to themselves be happy about. So some kind of achievements, you know. So be it winning a big fight against the dragon, for example, or sometimes even a big achievement is picklocking a door. So this is the thing: create some achievements for your players. It's more than just fights, and I think that most of the people tend to stay at the level of, oh, I put in so many orcs, I put in so many dragons, and we had a great game because they fight all the time. I would say fights should be, fights should be no more than 20% of the game. I would say it's more about, you know, the the smart talk, the interaction with the environment, and of course putting your finger on the map and drawing your map based on what the GM is telling you or revealing parts of it. It's up to, you know, the style, how you are playing. In Czech Republic, they came out with a game which was called the Dungeon of the Dragon. And they created actually a Czech version of it. So that's where we started. And then it was 2 years after the revolution, you know, in 1989, we had kind of a revolution in Europe where we changed our system from the communism into democracy. And quite a lot of things changed. We had McDonald's suddenly, and of course that also meant that there is a lot of more cultural stuff coming in, and it was same with role-playing games. At that time, there was a company called Altar, which started actually with role-playing games, and as for us, Dungeons and Dragons at that time was probably super expensive. They came up with a kind of a translated clone, easier version. So it was quite similar like Dungeons and Dragons. You had the same statistics, you had the same attributes. It was similar, using the similar dices, and it was quite similar and much more cheaper because we could buy the, I remember the first book which came out was like 150 pages and it was just printed pages, no pictures at all, and we had to actually put it together into a book at home. So it was just purely printed pages, and it was like $5 for a book, and you had one part of the book which was for the players, and the other part was for game masters. And already at that time, it was giving you ideas of how to be a game master, how to actually build a suspense, how to talk to the players, how to actually work out your stories, and that was the part, you know, where we came to even starting with map making first, you know, just having a hex paper and just drawing lines and making a lot of funny dungeons out of nothing really. So it was quite the start, and when I look back, it was low tech, but so much fun. So I would say even at the time we understood that you need something more than just the game itself to play. So you need some extra accessories, you need some even miniatures or even paper figures or of course maps to get more deeper into the game.
So we're interviewing experts on various roles and aspects of a game master, and one of the chief most things we associate with the GM is their world building. Some use published modules, some make their own. Either way, they have to provide the details to the players that convey the universe's mechanical and narrative details. The audience and players must enter in a state of willing suspension of disbelief, where the game matters and the characters exist. Bo does masterful map work, and this is one of the tools you use for world building. If you're not on the websites to see them, this map is called the Border Bridge, and it's an overhead view of a photorealistic-looking jungle, but there's something otherworldly about it as well. Down the center of the map is flowing water, and spanning the banks of the river is a bridge with a large guard tower on one end. The assets include day and night versions, as well as a grid and no grid. Can you walk through the process of world building in more depth?
For me, world building starts at the map. Yeah, for this bridge, what you're actually looking at is the I would say it's the promo picture. So there is a day and a night version of it. So the idea here was to have a bridge over a fast flowing river, and imagine the bridge is quite high, so it's much easier for the people to somehow get over the bridge. And the idea was with multiple options here to have the bridge to be a toll bridge where you have to go through the bridge, pay your toll. However, bringing in some extras, maybe you can't cross the bridge because the other side of the river is the, well, let's say the enemy nation, or it's held by some thieves, brigands, or bandits. So the game idea here was really to come up with a way for the players to clean the part of the bridge, so the tower part of the bridge, and that's why there is also a night version of it, because I think that when it comes to something like that, some would actually go and try to use the shadows to get closer, to climb and get up to the top floor, and maybe walk or get down through the top floor to the second floor and first floor, and fight through the three floors down to the first floor, and there opening the bridge and letting the rest of the group in to help out. So it's a very, very easy and very straightforward map, but there is especially that the bridge is a tall bridge. It makes sure that most of the action is actually happening on the bridge. However, I think you can also approach it head on. You have a wizard, and he can fly all the guys over to the top floor, or he can just blast the front gate away, and you can pile in and clean out the place there. So it's as you can see, the idea was based on having a straight line of sight from the bridge, of making it hard for just so go around it.
So those are great things to consider at a micro level, at the detail level. What about larger maps when you're looking at maybe something that's a little bit more zoomed out? And can you talk about your experiences with Asgard as well?
I'm actually moderating a group of 3,000 and growing on Facebook, which is the Asgard's Fantasy Map Generator. And I started with that too some 2 years ago, and it was a totally different story like it is right now. And nowadays with Asgard's Fantasy Map Generator, you don't generate a map really, but you are creating a world. You work it actually from so a single map can have everything from rainfall to wind to population levels, religion, diplomacy between countries, the disposition of armies, and right now the latest edition, which is going to be, is banners, coat of arms. So you will actually even have over your map a layer of coat of arms for not just for your countries, but for each of the province within your country. Asgard actually came up with a new tool, which is called Armoria. Armoria is a tool for making coat of arms and banners for your countries. So not just coat of arms, but flags as well. And it's huge. It has like endless options, and even within the endless options, you can customize so much that that if you are into such details like creating a coat of arms, then Armoria is your way to go.
So always Asgard?
In my world, it started with a map, and how it goes on, I'm writing it. I'm writing it into a book, and I'm writing it into a doc file, and I'm posting details of it.
And you don't just do maps, you also make tokens to go on those maps.
Lately, we started also adding tokens to our games. We see, you know, this change, and due to the virus troubles, a lot of people actually moved their game on VTTs, so on virtual tabletops, and a lot of games are actually being played online. I had a look at virtual tabletops for my flavor. I think it's not bad. However, we are playing with huge maps, so my maps are much bigger, and it's actually better details when you have a like 10,000 times and 8,000 pixel map. And VTTs usually either don't support such big maps, or they butcher the quality of such a huge map. So it's exactly the same problem when you are, for example, posting on Facebook a map. It butchers the quality because you really have just a small style of a map. So that's why I'm running most of the maps in HD on Patreon, where all these maps are actually in their best setup, best version. And due to this fact, we started actually a way of playing where we have a map and we have kind of a fog of battle, is it, I think, called? So where I prepare a map, and the map has multiple layers, and of course some of the layers are these tokens. What you see right now here is the tokens which are from front. However, the tokens created are top down, so you can actually see the top of their head and their shoulders and the weapon they are holding. What I'm creating with this page here is that it's actually easier to visualize what you really see from top down. So a lot of people, you know, create only a token from top down, and sometimes you have trouble to get the feel of how this token really looks like from the front. The undead as first, so zombies and skeletons, because those are the usual NPCs or enemies actually in our games. So zombies, zombie masters, different skeletons. Then we did a few anthropomorphic tokens, so get people and tokens based on a combination of a human and the animal. And the latest one is orcs. And I would say orcs are another prolific enemy in most of the games for the people. So I thought that orcs is to have a smaller clan of orcs with close combat fighters, with ranged fighters, with two bosses, and of course shamans to use magic or magicians. So this is actually the idea. If you see it, the tokens come in also in large size. So whoever is playing them is just downloading the tokens, and then they can adjust it to their own games. And what I'm using right now, as I said, is we don't use any VTT. We are using GIMP, which is kind of a I would say Photoshop for free, but it's quite good. So it's a software where you can actually paint or change your pictures or graphics, and I'm creating multiple layers on the gaming map, and some of the layers are actually the tokens. And you know, it's quite fine to use the tokens. You can turn them around, you can move them around as different layers. So you end up with a map and your tokens moving around. It looks like, well, you are basically playing chess on your setup. And really the idea came from the current situation with the virus, that more players are actually not able to meet up or even trying to play games with people from different countries. And I see this is quite happening right now. I see in my GURPS team, there is quite a lot of people who are looking for games or creating games and looking for players. And maybe this is going to be on one way the future of it, but I still like more to meet up with my friends, sit down and be, you know, like in the same room and chat about it, because it leaves a much more or a much deeper impression than just running it online. I'm already doing good when it comes to game mastering, hopefully, but I'm not the best. So let's continue on this road of getting better, of learning, of seeing how people do it, what people do. And well, I hope I can still be game master when I'm a grandpa, and when I'm 40, 50, 60, 70 years, 80 years old, and still can come together with some like-minded grandpas and grandmas, and we can run some game of Dungeons and Dragons 15th edition, probably.
So let's talk about some of the individual influences and details that go into creating a map like this. Like, how do you even come up with names for places, things like that?
As I said, I'm actually lucky because I grew up at a location where four countries meet. So, and I'm multilingual since I was born. So I have four mother tongues. Plus, I learned four additional languages in the last years while I'm actually moving around the world. I'm a digital nomad, and in the last 15 years, I lived in 9 different countries and visited much more of them. So, you know, this way you pick up languages where you are living, you pick up the local way of talking, and even when it comes to English, it's quite different. You know, I lived in Ireland, I lived in UK, in the US, and it's all different. The way how British speak is different, how Irish speak, how South Africans speak. So for me, I would say I even incorporate the way of a bit of Irish when my dwarves are talking. So so it's a way of talking and using the languages. When it comes actually when I'm world building, for example, I'm using quite a lot of foreign languages for naming. So be it from Japanese, Chinese, Mongolian, or crossover languages, using languages like even my own languages, but for example, cutting off parts and coming up with a specific a name just with like partial words, and it works. And sometimes even like writing or saying that these people, for example, speak Elvish, and Elvish is some other language which, for example, I can speak and one of the players. So it's good because I'm right now in such a multi-language area, so there is a lot of people here who speak German, Spanish, French, Italian. So we are sometimes incorporating these languages also into the game, or even I'm using the option, for example, my South African friend is using Afrikaans when his dwarf is speaking. So this is, I think, part of the thing where you can mix into your games quite a lot. And actually, my favorite world building tool, which is the fantasy map generator, is actually having over 40 possibilities when you are generating a world, how to play your naming conventions, from which country, or even go with different specific setups like gnomish or dark fantasy. So and I see that it gives a extra flavor when you have reptilian names, when you have for example, giant folk names in your maps, and the players pick it up, so they see the difference. Because if everything on your map is kind of a base English, and you have high peak and lowlands, and so such names, then the players don't really come up with some combination for it. So if you name some places a bit differently, and you give some specific naming for a different race, it will make them understand that this is something totally different. So you don't call an orcish place the Green Rocks, but you call them Ur-Guruk, and they will understand, oh, that sounds so orcish. So I would say this is the way how to incorporate languages, and not just languages, but even the way how other cultures work into your games.
We've spent a lot of time on maps and the process of world building there. What other things would you recommend to a game master that wanted to become better at world building that aren't maybe necessarily directly world building itself?
You need to try even different systems, try to play something different than just classic fantasy, because I would say with something like cyberpunk or science fiction, like Star Trek setup or even Star Wars we played, you start to see your game a bit differently than with classic fantasy only. Try different games. Go and be a vampire. That one really changed my view on playing Vampire the Masquerade, part of the World of Darkness game series. We are growing all the time. Life is a endless university. I'm always saying that. And in my work, I'm also training and teaching people how to translate, how to actually be linguists. You know, this is what I said before. I'm speaking many languages, and this is where my job is. I am actually working with translation in a translation business, global international translation business. And I'm always saying that you never stop growing. You never stop being on a way to become more. You always grow and you're always getting better. So I would say, until I feel that I'm doing good with my time, I'm busy, and I'm not a person who says, oh, I'm bored, because I don't really have time to be bored. So I'm going for my better self and finding a way of not just trying to be better, but trying to be more. And that's the learning thing. And a good job is done when there is one indicator I see always. When you finish the game, you still see the people, your players, chatting about what happened. And even after 2-3 days, you see messages popping up or people chatting about the game, like, well, this Sunday, that was so crazy, you know, when we went into that room with the red carpet and it just suddenly started everything exploding and those ghosts coming out from the mouths of the statues, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's something that you left an impression, you left some thinking with these guys and your players especially. So this is when I see that I did a good job, that they already think about the game even outside. They relive the excitement. They are reliving. Yeah, this is probably the good word for it. They are reliving the excitement that's happened during gameplay, even in later stages, even days after. And that's actually what I think a real and a good game master should do. He should create experiences and he should make the time great. You know, I still remember two or three of my characters I played like 15, 20 years ago.
Of course, there are many ways to play, and so many aspects of being a good GM. Please check out the website for resources and more episodes. Thank you for your time speaking with us today, Beau, and thank you listeners for learning with us. Free stuff on the Patreon. May your games bring you joy, and see you next time.